every day, ask yourself, do you wanna be happy? Yes, pull over, let him drive.
Just wanna be happy.
Good morning, I am your host, Wang Yi Kiara, and you tuned into another episode of Crucial Questions here on Pearl Radio. As we delve into our topic today, we want you to consider, have you ever felt buffeted by the swirling currents of thought and ideas that surround us in this rapidly changing world? It is a reality that we face, a reality that emphasizes the importance of being grounded in solid truth about what we believe in. In his book, The Story of Reality, Greg Kuckel says that truth is not a set of isolated and unconnected claims, but rather stands as a coherent whole. The Apostle Paul warns us in Ephesians 4:14, not to be tossed here and there by waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of man, by craftiness and deceitful scheming. These words resonate deeply in our present context, where the erosion of foundational ideas such as absolute truth and the entry of ideas as universalism, pluralism, have made the defense of God's truth far more crucial than ever before. But let's not forget that even before our time, there were thinkers who diligently constructed frameworks to defend the existence of God and validity of the Christian faith. Yet in our contemporary society, where skepticism and doubts are pervasive, the need for a robust defense of God becomes increasingly necessary. Christian, what do you think about God? Do you truly understand why you believe in Him? Are you prepared to give a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you? So, dear listeners, I invite you to sit back, tune in, and join us on this enlightening conversation here on Pearl Radio 96.9 FM. Today, in our fourth episode, we have the privilege of being joined by a good friend of mine, Danson Otawa, the Kenya director of ACFA, which is the Africa Center for Apologetics Research. Danson brings in with him a wealth of knowledge and experience in the field of apologetics, which is not merely a cosmetic addition to Christianity, but an absolute necessity in our time. Danson, karibu. Please tell us something about yourself, a quick introduction.
Thank you so much, Mwangi, for the invitation, and I am well pleased. And yes, my name is Danson Otawa, and as you've heard, I serve with a ministry called Africa Center for Apologetics Research as the national director for the Kenyan office. Our ministry is majorly focused on equipping Christians in three things: in discernment, defense of faith, and cult evangelism. So we make it our goal to reach out to the church and, just as a medium, help them understand the crucial role of apologetics in everyday life in a Christian.
And what are you doing with your usual self during the week?
Well, most of the things, I am involved in lots of ministry in campus, especially in our universities here locally. But I also host a podcast called the Christian Life Podcast every other week. And if I'm not doing these things, I'm involved in my local church as well.
Okay. Yeah. Now, on to it. This big word called apologetics. What is apologetics and why is it important for the Christian to engage in this discipline? Give us a working definition.
Many people want to think of apologetics as making an apology, like, you know, making, I'm sorry, saying I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But this word apologetics comes actually from the Greek word apologia, which actually just means making a defense. And a guy called Dr. Paul Coulter describes or defines apologetics as persuasively explaining the plausibility, rationality, and truth of Christianity, and revealing the implausibility, irrationality, and falsehood of other competing worldviews. By plausibility, it just means the reasonability and the probability of the Christian faith. So when you are doing apologetics, you are making a defense. You're clarifying why you believe what you believe. It's like saying, I am explaining the why behind the what of what I believe in. Yeah.
If that is the case, then everybody is an apologetic. Everybody really is an apologetic. It just depends on how good or bad you are, and I'm sure we'll touch on this later, but maybe something on that.
Yeah. When you begin a conversation by saying, I am wearing a white shirt, and I say, I don't think you're wearing a white shirt, the next thing you're going to do is run for the next 5 minutes trying to explain to me why that
shirt is
white. Essentially defend the assertion that you're wearing a white shirt.
Exactly.
And so if somebody says, I think about, and goes on to say something about God, they're really giving an apologetic about God.
Yes.
A good one or a bad one,
yes.
Either way they're giving an apologetic.
Yeah. In other words, what they're saying is it true? Does it make sense? Could it work for me?
Yeah.
Is it useful? They're saying they want answers for their reality, rationality, plausibility, and relevance of Christianity, or even relevance of why God exists.
It might think of two distinct things. Like, there's a gospel. On the one hand, the gospel is the power of God unto salvation.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say apologetics is the power of God unto salvation.
Yeah.
How are these two things related? And if a Christian has to choose between the two, I mean, do I even choose what is there to do?
It's interesting that people would want to think about apologetics as a distinction from the gospel.
Almost as though it's only for a certain kind of academics to pursue, but the rest of us can be content with our little church experience.
1 Peter 3:15 helps me here, and I think should be helpful for us to see if there's a relationship between apologetics and the gospel. 1 Peter 3:15-17 says, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. The hope that is in you is actually, that word is explained in 1 Peter 1 from verse 3 all the way to 11. And when you read verse 3 to 11 of 1 Peter, it's actually the gospel, what God has done to us and for us. So when you're doing apologetics, you are explaining the gospel in a way, in a manner that is understood, relatable, plausible, and rational. And so there is not necessarily a distinction, but there is a relationship. So apologetics is like a maiden.
Do you feel like it's probably the foundation for the gospel to make sense or to be even plausible?
Yes.
Then there has to be an apologetic of sorts,
whether
or not I realize it. If I'm saying Jesus died for your sins,
yes,
that is bracketed within a context, like who is Jesus?
Right.
Oh, he's the Son of God. Who is God?
Yeah.
Then it has to be.
Yeah.
There has to be some sort of foundation. For us to even have that discussion.
I think the easier way of actually understanding this would be to say apologetics is communicating the gospel. So that the how of the communication is the apologetic. You are making a defense. You are communicating in a manner that is compelling, that is inviting, that is also defending. So there's a very crucial relationship here. When Paul is explaining the gospel, majorly, especially, for example, in Acts 17, he's explaining the gospel to a skeptic. So what is he doing? He is doing an apologetic. He's making a defense. So there's quite a relationship there, which we should not think about these things in different categories.
Draw a line between them and think of them as separate disciplines. It's either you do this or I do this, and then some Christians will do that, and I'll do this.
Yes.
Sort of thing. Moving ahead, some arguments for God, but I felt before we go to arguments for God. There's certain ideas, we were talking just as we were prepping, there's ideas that have taken root from, centuries ago that almost ended up undermining the whole idea of existence of God, for example. For me to say there is a God, in times past, there may have been certain societal ideas that would have aided that argument. So it would have been easier to do it, for example, the whole notion of absolute truth, for example, that was widely accepted.
Yes.
But now has been punctured to the point of it probably isn't a thing that is as firm as it once was.
Yeah.
And so maybe we can touch on certain ideas that you feel have undermined before we go to the arguments, three basic arguments for beginners level, because I have to add that we are not actually dealing with very deep level apologetics. This is something that could take days, so it's very beginner level. Go ahead.
These ideas are the way in which people view the world. So it's kind of like a worldview. It's competing worldviews against Christianity or things that have come in between our understanding of God.
Yeah.
And one of this, I would say, is the idea of universalism.
Yeah.
That
all roads lead to God, you know, it doesn't matter where you come from. I can be worshipping the God in the mountain, I can be worshipping or practicing some kind of mystical ideas, but
as long as we meet at the top, then it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And this...
It's the idea that somebody says... There's one God. Everyone knows it's just the same God.
Yes,
it's the same God. It's
yes.
Just different practices or expressions of it.
Different parts to the same God.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a very Eastern idea.
And the Christian, the Christian opposition to that would be
that truth is one. It's absolute and has been revealed in a person, Christ Jesus.
He's the way, the truth,
and yes, and he says in John 14:6, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. So there is an absolute proclamation that's already been made, so that if you don't come through Christ, you don't find your way to God.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that a road to somewhere has to be that road, other than, I mean, it probably would break down in that sense, but God has said the only way to him is through Jesus Christ.
Yes.
So that there's no other road. Even if
yeah.
we say there's another, there isn't, is it?
Yes, yes.
And that is different from pluralism, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very different from pluralism, because in pluralism, we are saying there is no one God, it's just many gods. And these many gods are not leading to one end. They're leading to different ends. Doesn't matter what you worship, as long as we are
but
existing.
That is okay. But that
then
is,
that's okay.
That's right, yeah.
Yes. I will worship my God, you would worship your God, and as long as we are living in harmony, that's okay.
Which I guess would go against most religions, because every religion is, let me say, quote unquote, arrogant in that sense.
Yes.
That we are saying we are the way.
Yeah.
God says, I am the way, the truth, and
yeah.
It's a very, let me say, righteously arrogant, let's say,
yes.
Since the Lord of
yes.
Minagur, arrogant,
yes.
It's a very righteously arrogant statement,
yeah.
Which is,
mm-hmm.
take it or leave it. It's not
yeah.
like, you could try Jesus at some
yes.
point, you could try God,
yeah.
and kind of,
yeah.
you know, even this other guy can
mm-hmm.
make sense, and we all, so
yes.
that's what pluralistic
yeah.
Ideology is.
And then, and one of the motivations for pluralism is, we want to coexist and things like that.
Yes.
But with the moment you start claiming exclusivity to your own, you are saying all the others are false.
Mm.
So that's a very, pluralism always falls apart,
yeah.
because it doesn't have its anchor on the indigenous idea of my truth is my truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to be able to defend whatever you're following.
Either way, and if you think about it logically, either I am right and you're wrong.
Yes.
Or we're both wrong. We can't,
yeah, like
we can't both be right.
I really like that, yes.
So
yes.
Someone has to be wrong.
Someone has to be wrong, yes. And it transitions into this other worldview called relativism.
Yeah.
Where my truth is my truth and your truth is your truth. And there's no such thing as an absolute truth.
Yeah, in fact, there's this example given. Like, if you draw a number 9, then,
yeah.
it's, then it's not the 9 we know, the 9 that is in print.
Yes.
And if Wambo here is looking at it, it's a 6 to her.
Yeah.
But if I'm looking at it, it's a 9.
Yes.
But there's somebody who wrote that number, and that person intended a certain number.
Yes.
So that it doesn't matter whether Wambo is looking at it as 6.
Yeah.
I wrote it as a 9, and therefore it is a 9.
Yes.
Yeah.
Would
that be pluralistic or universalistic? Or?
Yeah. I would say that's relativist.
Relativist.
Yes, I choose how to interpret what I choose how to interpret.
Yeah.
Not relating that to a framework that's been given to me.
Okay.
I choose to define the frameworks with which I interpret reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We want to touch on 4 basic arguments for God.
Yeah.
Anyone who's like, you know, in a matatu and wants to capture this thing in 5-10 minutes,
mm.
and I have to state again that we're not solving apologetics in this
yeah.
short 30-minute episode.
Yeah.
It's more like an anchor point to give people and say, hey, these are some framework you can build and then go explore for yourself.
Yeah.
First argument for God.
This is, I would say, one of the strongest arguments. Not the strongest, but one of the strongest arguments. It's called the cosmological argument.
Mm-hmm.
And cosmology just means study of beginnings. Cosmos, how things have begun,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. And this is how it goes in short. You say, whatever begins to exist has a cause, right?
Yeah.
Of course, something can't just come into being, right?
Yeah.
The universe began to exist.
Yeah.
So that means the universe has a cause.
Now, whatever this cause is, must be uncaused, must be beginningless.
That thing cannot have a cause, because if it did have a cause, then it would move to the other thing.
Yeah,
you would
have to be regressing infinitely.
Yeah.
Yes. It must be timeless as well. Must be spaceless. It must be powerful.
Yeah.
And it also must be personal. And there has not been a description like that to any entity apart from God.
Yeah.
Across history.
In fact, I had a very interesting line by an apologist once. He said, literally the first verse of the Bible is, in the beginning, time, God created the heavens, space, and the earth, matter. But those things begin to exist at the same time.
Exactly.
And nothing else. And it says God was there before.
Yes.
Yeah.
So God is not constrained by time, space, and matter.
Because if he is, then he can't be. He can't be God.
He can't
if
be
he's
God.
Constrained by time, it means he had a beginning.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so everything that has a cause, everything that begins, or everything that exists, must needs have a cause.
Yes. The universe begin to exist.
Yeah.
The universe has a cause, and so we have to define what that cause is.
Yeah.
And in this case, this cause is uncaused, beginningless, timeless, spaceless, powerful, but also personal. That's God.
It's maybe something additional about the personal nature of it. It's not so much that we have an entity called God that is far removed from our universe.
Yes.
It's that the most powerful being in the universe has almost, how do I put this? Has wanted to have a relationship.
Yeah.
Desires to have a relationship. He doesn't need it, but he's desiring, which is actually a very humbling thing to think. And argument number two.
So the second argument would be what we call the fine tuning of the universe.
Also known as a teleological
argument. Yes, teleological argument.
Okay.
Yeah. So it goes in three premises. The first premise is the fine tuning of the universe for intelligent life is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Now, the second premise says it's not due to physical necessity or chance. And the third premise is therefore it's due to design. So the question then is, who has designed it? How has he designed it? The question of who has designed it has not been answered by science. The question of how he has designed it has been answered by science to a small extent.
Yeah.
It's like one in a trillion ways
of
understanding how he has designed it. And there is a relationship between the teleological argument, the cosmological argument, because the teleological argument is looking for who has designed, what's the nature of the designer. If the designer causes things to happen, then the designer must be uncaused. If the designer sets time in motion, then the designer must be timeless. If the designer sets space, matter, and things like that, the designer then must be
exist outside of these things.
Exactly.
And if I found a beautiful portrait, an art piece, it implies not only like creativity, of course, there's many things that
what's beautiful, that's amazing,
but it also implies something without implying it out overtly.
Yes.
It's like there was someone who sat down and actually drew this picture.
Yes.
So, an opposition that would be, I mean, various explanations that are given towards like the earth and everything. You know, there was this particle floating in space and just happened to explode, and then suddenly you have male feelings, you have emotions like love, you have, you know, things that, you know, hopes and dreams. Do you feel like it's perhaps a very big stretch to move from nothing and then suddenly we have human beings with organs and hopes and dreams and emotions? Something to answer?
I think the question to ask to such a criticism, which I think is raised well, is to go back and ask what's the origin of that particle or that cell. Where does it start? Is it infinite regress? If it's infinite regress, then we actually are not thinking. We don't have something absolute, something to latch on.
Yeah.
Interesting thing is the Bible or the Christian faith gives us the answer to that question of the origin.
And we've talked about the teleological argument.
Yeah.
And now we'll move to the moral argument,
right,
which is, I think, one of my favorite. Tell us a bit more about the moral argument.
Yeah. This one actually stops everyone in the tracks because there's so much reality to it. Here's how it goes. If God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. That's the first premise. The second premise goes something like this. objective moral values and duties do exist. And what we mean by values, it has to do with good or bad, you know, things to do with moral worth. And duties, it has to do with obligations, right or wrong, okay? So objective moral values and duties do exist. Therefore, God exists.
And if you are explaining that to a group of class fives, you're basically saying, if I say something is good or bad, it must therefore mean that there is something else I'm comparing that thing to.
Yes.
And if I go back and back and back and back, there has to be a standard that we all agreed toward.
Right.
And say then, compared to this standard, that is good or bad.
Right.
So could you flesh that a little bit?
Yeah. So when you say, and this is, I think this is a bit the better way to say it.
Okay.
If a skeptic would say, you know, my argument against God's existence is a problem of evil. There's so much evil in the
world.
And
that's a thing that's often brought up.
Right.
Like God can't, how can I, if there's so much evil, how can a good God
exist? Yes. And the next question to ask then is, what do you mean by evil? Evil according to whom? Because evil is not an entity in itself. Evil cannot exist on its own. Evil exists because good exists, just like...
So to the left or the right of
good.
Then evil lies there.
Yes.
It has to be to the left or right or something.
Yes. So then we ask the question, who is the source? Who writes the rules? Who determines whether something is good or bad? Yes.
And God is right at the center.
Yes, God is at the right at the center because in God there is justice and mercy. Something you cannot understand with your own mind. But in justice, he defines right and wrong. And in mercy, he deals with the issue of right and wrong, and good and bad, through Jesus Christ. So in other words, what I'm saying is, the moral argument argues for what you and I can relate to. When a child is killed innocently, we say that's evil.
Yeah.
We are saying that because ingrained in us is the idea that there is absolute good or absolute truth.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because remove that absolute good or truth, then it really doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It really doesn't matter if someone is killed, if someone is maimed or harmed.
Yes.
It really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because the question would always be like, according to whom?
According to,
like, says who?
Yes.
You know, that's the thing. And finally, you have the resurrection of Christ.
Yeah.
Which many would think is the Bible is a mythical book and collection of, you know, some Middle Eastern stories about a certain Middle Eastern man who existed at a certain time, apparently resurrected. But you're saying that the resurrection of Christ is actually a historical event that happened.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a historical event because we have historical documents that prove that that historical event happened. And one of those historical documents is the Bible. And
the Bible is in itself a historical document.
Yeah. Many people want to say we have biblical evidence and extra-biblical evidence. They say, no, the Bible is one of the evidences that Jesus Christ actually did exist.
Yeah.
He lived a perfect life here on earth, and he was crucified by normal human beings under the decree of a certain leadership that was there. So in other words, the death and resurrection of Christ is historically verifiable. It is something that we can go back to. And not only the Bible, but we also have other sources, like the works of Josephus. We have the works of Tacitus, the works of Pliny the Younger. These are historians. These are people who lived in an actual time in history who actually write about a resurrected Jesus. They also write about a Jesus before the resurrection who lived and taught and did all manner of miracles. And so the fact that Jesus Christ resurrected from the dead authenticates the Christian faith. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ did not rise from the dead, then we are most to be pitied. Our faith is basically futile if Christ did not rise from the dead. The reason Christ's resurrection is very important is because he claimed to be God. And so his resurrection is a vindication to this, to you and I who are onlookers, that he is actually God. There's never been a man in life and time in history who has actually made such a bold claim and stood by his word, even today. And his followers, thousands and thousands of followers, have been willing to die, put their lives on basically death row because of this resurrected Jesus.
Yeah.
A famous historian, Tertullian, says the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The church has grown because people believed in the resurrection.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's a good. And even as we draw this to a close, I suppose sometimes I'd be seated here thinking, what's the big deal about apologetics? I just want to worship Jesus in my own corner there.
Yeah.
I don't want so many things. And even if this is a thing that for the dancers of this world.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What's a big deal about this?
Apologetics is, first of all, worshiping God with our mind. Matthew 22:37-38 says, and he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. When we put our mind to exercise thinking about God, we are doing apologetics. Why? Because we are reasoning out the reality and reasonability of the faith. Apologetics also is always a spiritual battleground. Why? Because we are saying things about God that refute other ideas. I like what 2 Corinthians 10:3-6 says, for though we walk in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare are not for the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy what? Arguments, every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to obey Christ. So this is an exercise for every believer, because we are faced by falsehood left, right, center.
Yeah.
Competing worldviews, competing thoughts and ideas.
And at the end of the day, you're saying, it's not so much I am not an apologist or I am. It's really how good an apologist
you are. Oh, yes.
I am, isn't it?
Yes. And how good an apologist you are does not mean you should. Well, you could go to seminary, yes, that's okay. But reading your Bible is the start.
It's really the biggest start you can have.
Just know what you believe.
Which I feel is very accessible to many, because many would be thinking, man, that's PhD level education.
Right.
It starts by reading my Bible.
Yes.
It?
And then willing to reason out with other people who do not agree with you.
Yeah.
And once you're willing to go into it and reason with other people, then you're doing apologetics.
Yeah. Danson, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights on such a profound and essential questions. To our listeners, thank you for joining us today. If any of you have any discussions that have sparked questions or ideas that you're wanting to discuss further, or if you want to explore this topic any further than you have, go to our website www.crucialquestions.org. Follow my Twitter handle at Mwangi Kiara. Mwangi Kiara carries out without a H. Also, our guest here works for an organization called ACFA, which we talked about earlier, Africa Center for Apologetics Research, www.acfa.org. Visit that website for more resources. Perhaps you want to delve deeper into our topic today, I highly recommend picking up a copy of On Guard by William Lane Craig, Tactics by Greg Coco, that is, and Near Christianity by C.S. Lewis. Remember to join us every Wednesday from 10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. only here on Pala Radio 96.9 FM. From me, your host, Mwangi Kiara, it's always a joy to have you with us. Until next time, God bless.